On May 30th, 2003, Al Franken's The Waitress and the Lawyer was presented at the Belasco Theater in New York. It was directed by Mike Nichols with the following cast: Donna, Queen Latifah; Allison, Helen Hunt; Urban Cowboy, Brian Dennehy. Scenery and lighting by Alex Jones. Costumes by Edie Hallway. The action of the play takes place in a diner in Houston, Texas, on April 14, 2003. It was performed without intermission. The Waitress and the Lawyer, a one-act play, by Al Franken, from an idea by George W. Bush. Set: a clean, well-lit diner. It's 11 at night. Allison, a slim, well-dressed lawyer in her middle 30s, sets herself down at the counter. Donna, a plump waitress in her late 20s, approaches with a pot of coffee and a friendly smile.
Can I help you, Suge?
Yes, please. Double cappuccino and a biscotti.
Sorry. How about coffee and a slice of pie?
No pie for me. I'm on a diet.
You on a diet? If I had your figure, I'd have pie for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Oh, what the hell. That lemon meringue looks great. Besides, it's going to be a long night.
You working the night shift, too?
Well, in a manner of speaking, I'm a tax attorney, and April's my busiest month.
Well, don't look for any business from me. Thanks to President Bush, I won't be paying any taxes this year.
You mean income taxes, Donna. Do you mind if I call you Donna? I read your name tag.
Sure.
Donna, how much do you make?
Well,
come on, just between us gals.
$25,000.
Wow, that puts you in the top 10% of all waitresses. And how much in tips?
That's including tips. I report every cent. In this country, if you play by the rules and work hard, you can make a better life for yourself.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry about it, Suge. I'll wipe that up. But what's so funny?
It's just that what you said is so sweet and naive. Sure, you're getting $365 cut in your income tax, but you're forgetting the $3,825 that was withheld in payroll taxes.
Oh, I don't mind the payroll taxes, because I'll get back every cent in Social Security and Medicare when I retire.
Honey, Bush raided the Social Security and Medicare trust funds to pay for my tax cut.
He did?
Yes. He took a $4.6 trillion 10-year projected surplus and turned it into a $1.8 trillion deficit. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Let's say this pile of salt is the surplus that we had under Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And this pile of sugar represents the Bush deficit.
Would you mind not doing that?
Sorry. My point is that eventually someone is going to have to replace all that sugar in the packet and, well, clean up the mess. And I got a feeling it's going to be you or your kids. You got kids?
Donna starts cleaning up Allison's mess.
Dude! Teddy's 6. He has some learning disabilities, but he's the sweetest boy. And Debbie's 3, and quite a handful, let me tell you, especially for a single mom like me.
You know, I'm a single mom myself.
No kidding.
Donna stops cleaning up and leans forward to hear about Allison's kids.
Yep. In fact, my oldest has a learning disability, too. Good thing I have him in private school, because the public schools are cutting back on special ed.
Yeah, I know. They told me that next year Teddy's not getting special ed. Also, they're cutting the after-school program.
That's because Bush proposed cutting the 21st Century Community Learning Centers by 40%.
Bush did that? Well, I still like him, because he cut my taxes 100%.
Your income taxes, but you only paid $365. That after-school program alone was spending $700 a student. So, in a sense, you're already down $335.
You are good with numbers. No wonder you're a tax attorney.
But you know, Donna, I'd be less worried about the after-school cuts and more worried about losing your kids' health insurance. Here in Texas, they're reducing eligibility in the SHIP program from $30,520 down to $22,890.
SHIP? But that's how my kids get their Medicaid coverage.
Yes, you're losing, let's see, Medicaid coverage is worth to kids about $2,896 a year right there.
Oh, no. What if they get sick?
Just hope they don't. And you can blame George Bush. Because of the huge tax cut, the federal government can't fulfill their normal obligations to the states.
Unfunded mandates.
Hey, you know the lingo.
Yeah, we have Fox News on here all the time. That's why I knew I was getting 100% of my taxes cut.
Donna, mind if I ask you a personal question?
If it's the recipe for the pie, no can do.
No, it's not the pie.
Tell you the truth, we get it from a bakery.
Donna, do you live in subsidized housing?
Why, yes. We get our Section 8 housing voucher in the mail every month.
Oh, dear. I'm afraid your Section 8 voucher is about to disappear. I'm guessing you live in a two-bedroom apartment with minimum amenities and rent in the 40th percentile range, say about $747 a month.
That's right on target.
So your voucher is about $1,464 a year.
Wow. If I ever have to pay taxes again, I'm coming straight to you.
Anyway, that's gone. So let's see. After school, $700. Medicaid, $2,896. Housing, $1,464. So less your $365 tax cut, you're down $4,695.
Well, Lord knows, I've been through hard times before. But as long as I have my child care, at least I can work without worrying about my kids. What's that look?
Texas is getting less funding for its temporary assistance for needy families. So they're cutting back on child care and development block grants.
But I don't get block grants.
Yeah, but your child care provider probably does. Or did, I should say.
How's the pie?
Donna, how do you get to work?
Are they doing something to my bus?
Probably not, and that's the point. The state senate just cut public transit funding by 29%. They were going to upgrade the buses to cut down on the toxic emissions. Now they're keeping the old buses and raising the fares.
Debbie does get asthma on bad smog days.
Pie's great.
In the background, we can hear Sean Hannity on the television.
That's class warfare. Shaw, the top 1% are... I don't want to hear your talking points. Nearly 4 million Americans have been cut from the tax rolls.
The two women avoid each other's eyes. Finally, Donna raises the coffee pot.
Can I top that off for you?
No thanks, Donna. I should get back to work.
So, I take it you're not voting for Bush next time?
Are you kidding? I make $250,000 a year. I love Bush.
How big is your tax cut?
I'm going to get $6,000, which is about 16 times as much as you. And, of course, the program cuts don't affect me. But the big payoff comes when my mother passes away. She's on life support.
I'm so sorry.
Are you kidding? If she can hang on until 2010, I'm getting $12 million. Tax-free. That's about a $6 million tax break.
Oh, the repeal of the death tax. I saw that on Fox, too. I guess that's fair, because that money was already taxed once when it was earned.
My mom? Work? Oh, no, no, no. It's mostly capital gains. Never been taxed, and now never will be. Unlike your tips. Speaking of which, how much do I owe you?
Well, let's see. They just raised the sales tax. I guess $4.87.
Change of 50?
Sure, Donna.
Allison hands her a 50. Donna makes change. Allison gives her a 10.
You don't have to do that.
Hey, we working moms got to stick together, right?
Right.
Allison gives her a wink, and she leaves, passing an urban cowboy who's just put a quarter in the jukebox. Donna looks at the TV, then down at the half-cleaned-up piles of sugar and salt. Slowly, she sweeps them into her palm as the urban cowboy sits down at the counter.
Can I help you, Shug?
Just a cup of joe, I guess. I just got laid off.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. You work at the plant?
No, I'm a special ed teacher.
Curtain. The Gospel of Supplies Side Jesus. Pontius Pilate summons our hero.
Bring me this king of the Jews that I might meet him, this supply-side Jesus.
Supply-side Jesus arrives.
So you are the supply-side Jesus. What a magnificent robe you have.
Because of this robe, 10 craftsmen were able to feed their families. The goldsmith who made the trim and the filigree was able to hire an apprentice because I paid him so handsomely.
And what a beautiful haircut you have, supply-side Jesus.
The barber who gave me this haircut was able to hire a manicurist. She had been a prostitute, but because I needed a pedicure, she is now able to fulfill her true potential.
Yes, the cuticles are absolutely perfect. But there are those in Jerusalem who are not happy with your radical new teaching, supply-side Jesus. Watch yourself.
Supply-side Jesus, mounted on his prized camel, leads his disciples past a leper colony on his way to the Sermon on the Mount.
Should you feed the lepers, supply-side Jesus?
No, Thomas. That would just make them lazy.
Then shouldn't you at least heal them, supply-side Jesus?
No, James. Leprosy is a matter of personal responsibility. If people knew I was healing the lepers, there would be no incentive to avoid leprosy.
Supply-side Jesus, I think I've got a great line for your Sermon on the Mount. It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven.
For shame, Peter. That's class warfare. But it does give me an idea. The Sermon on the Mount.
It is easier for a rich man to enter heaven seated comfortably on the back of a camel than it is for a poor man to pass through the eye of a needle. If you are prosperous on earth, that means that God is rewarding your rugged individualism. If you are poor, it is a sign that God frowns on your reliance on handouts. The only way to gain entrance into God's kingdom of abundance is to show your faith by giving to him through his only son, me, supply-side Jesus. My disciples will now pass among you, and he who gives more than 1,000 shekels will become a supply-side Jesus pioneer and have access to me at our annual Yom Kippur Break the Fast Dinner.
The Word of the Lord!
The Last Supper.
This very night, one of you will betray me to pay off a gambling debt.
No, said Simon the Canaanite.
I don't believe it,
said James the Greater.
Not I, said Philip of Bethesda.
Not us, said James the Lesser.
Oh boy, thought William Bennett Iscariot.
Supply-side Jesus was arrested that very night and brought before Pontius Pilate.
Supply-side Jesus, the Pharisees are angry. They say you are cutting into their action.
That's the marketplace of ideas, Pilate.
But your ideas are misleading, and you are making the poor even poorer. What do you say to that, supply-side Jesus?
Pilate, average income is going up, and social mobility within the Roman Empire is greater than ever. Look at me. I came from the humblest of roots, and yet now I am one of the richest men in all Judea.
That's because you're a huckster, supply-side Jesus. I sentence you to death by crucifixion.
It was Passover custom to release a condemned prisoner. Pilate decided to let the people choose supply-side Jesus' fate.
Who would you have me release? This man, supply-side Jesus, who claims to be your king, and insists you stand on your own 2 feet? Or in the case of you lepers, your good foot and stump? Or this man, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who also claims to be your king and preaches a gospel of compassion, generosity, and good works?
20 shekels for anyone who votes for me, supply-side Jesus said.
Give us supply-side Jesus!
The next day, supply-side Jesus passed by Calvary on his way out of town.
Forgive them, Father.
Supply-side Jesus knew just what to do.
Romans! Tax cuts will double our revenues and ensure that the empire never declines or falls. And I will stop these environmentalists who claim that lead is poisoning our water system. And I will eliminate the threat from Mesopotamia once and for all by invading Iraq.
Chapter 37. I challenge Rich Lowry to a fight. Rich Lowry is an editor at the National Review. If you watch cable news, you've probably seen his head talking here or there, arguing the conservative position on some issue of the day. He's pretty young, I'd say about 40 now. He's not bad as these guys go, fairly articulate. He even enjoyed a run as a semi-regular on the NewsHour. One area where Lowry seems paleo-conservative, though, is in the realm of gender politics. When Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift had twins, he called for her to step down. I agreed, but that was because she was a Republican. As you may have figured out by now, I'm a bit of a C-SPAN junkie, and a couple years ago, late at night, I caught Rich talking, I think to some college Republicans. He was saying that Democrats had feminized politics. In fact, by making it okay for politicians to cry, Lowry said, that we Democrats had sissified politics. There seemed to be only one thing to do. The next day, I called the National Review and got Rich's direct line. I remember the conversation very clearly. Rich.
Hello?
Rich, Al Franken, how do you do?
Fine. To what do I owe the honor of your call?
Well, I saw you on C-SPAN last night talking about how we Democrats had sissified politics, so I thought I'd challenge you to a fight.
A fight?
Yeah, I figured the loser gives $1,000 to the winner's charity.
Where would we fight?
In my parking garage.
Parking garage?
Yeah.
What would the rules be?
Oh, no rules. It's like Fight Club.
Fight Club?
Yeah, no weapons or anything. The first to say uncle loses.
You want to fight me in a garage with no rules?
Yeah. If you win, I have to give to some nutty right-wing cause. If I win, you have to give to, I don't know, NARAL or Emily's List.
Can I ask you something?
Sure, Rich.
Do you fight a lot?
No. I've actually never been in a fight. But I wrestled in high school, and I'm pretty confident I could beat you. Then again, I'm 50 and have a bad back, but I think I could take you. At any rate, I just don't want this Democrats of sissified politics to stand, so I want to fight you.
Can I take a day or two to decide?
Sure, take your time. I just figured anyone who said that the Democrats had sissified politics would kind of have to fight.
I understand, but how about if I sleep on it?
Absolutely. I'll call you tomorrow.
Okay, sure.
It was an extremely satisfying phone call. Sizing Lowry up on TV, he seemed just a tad on the wimpy side, which had only been confirmed by his reaction. Terrified. I was just a decent high school wrestler, but I was convinced I could take him down, then basically punch his ears till he called uncle. Later that day, I happened to tell my son Joe about the call. He thought it was a bad idea. Dad, if he turns you down, he's going to feel like a total wimp.
Well, that's the point, son. I couldn't allow him to challenge the manhood of us Democrats.
Yeah, but that's not nice. If he says he won't do it, promise me you'll tell him you were kidding.
Why?
It might make him feel like he's a little more off the hook.
Oh, okay, if he backs out, I'll tell him I was kidding.
But if he accepts, I'll kick his ass, I said. Frankly, I think Joe was kind of impressed. I called Lowry the next day. As I expected, he said, I've decided this is something I don't want to do. Then he said something about crying himself to sleep the night before, which was a joke, but of course he was kidding on the square. So I did what I promised Joe and told Lowry that I had been kidding and then suggested we had lunch. We did, and had a perfectly lovely time. A few weeks later, Lowry was on the NewsHour. Joe, I shouted, this is the guy. Joe ran in from his room and saw Jim Lehrer.
Dad, he's like 70.
No, not him. The guy he's talking to. The shot cut to Lowry, and the moment my son saw him, Joe scoffed.
Aw, this guy? He's a wuss.
Yeah, he is, I shrugged.
Joe just shook his head and went back to his room with, if possible, even less respect for his father. But I'll tell you this. I've seen Rich Lowry on television plenty of times since then, and I think he's dropped the whole Democrats have feminized politics thing. But if he hasn't, I'll be glad to meet him anytime in my parking garage. Chapter 38, Vast Lagoons of Pig Feces, The Bush Environmental Record. I want to draw you a word picture of a lagoon. This is not an azure lagoon trimmed with pearly beaches and wreathed with leafy palm trees. Not the type of lagoon you may remember from Gilligan's Island, where a caged lion or an Indian in a canoe might wash up just to get that week's episode rolling. This lagoon is a rectangle the size of 3 football fields, lined with 40-mil high-density polyethylene, and filled to a depth of 30 feet with pig shit. Now imagine that at the bottom of the lagoon, pebbles have punctured the liner, allowing the liquefied pig shit to seep under and ferment. A bubble is growing. The polyethylene liner rises like a creature from the brown lagoon. It breaks the surface, spilling a pungent stew of untreated feces and urine into a nearby creek. An undocumented Guatemalan worker is ordered to puncture the liner with a shotgun blast. Retching, he fires. The swollen liner retreats into the fetid depths. Mission accomplished. The next day, however, one of the most magnificent sights in all of nature, a shit geyser, explodes into the afternoon sky. Those working nearby watch the pillar rise 10, then 20, then 30 feet above the lagoon. It is as though the earth itself is afflicted with a virulent case of projectile diarrhea. Hold that image in your mind. George W. Bush is the worst environmental president in our nation's history. As you listen to this, his self-interested coterie of industry shills are dismantling the protections that you and I take for granted. Our air, our water, and wildlife are under attack. How could this have happened under the watch of a man who spoke so passionately and with such quiet eloquence to this very issue in his very first presidential Earth Day speech? Each of us understands that our prosperity as a nation will mean little if our legacy to future generations is a world of polluted air, toxic waste, and vanished forests. I encourage Americans to join me in renewing our commitment to protecting the environment and leaving our children and grandchildren with a legacy of clean water, clean air, and natural beauty. I know I joined him in renewing my commitment. Not too many people realize how much celebrities can do to improve the environment. Remember how I'm a nut for statistics? Well, not too many people realize this, but showbiz celebrities make up just 0.000001% of the world's population and yet consume nearly 37% of its resources. For example, every day, 17 acres of rainforest are consumed by Barbara Streisand alone. After Bush's speech, determined to do my part, I wasted almost 20 minutes trying to persuade my son to accept the Prius as a graduation gift in place of the 280-horsepower Infiniti G35 coupe I had promised him in a weak moment. So I'm pulling my weight. I wish I could say the same for J. Stephen Griles, the Deputy Secretary of the Interior. Instead of renewing his commitment, like the president told him to, Griles has opened public lands to oil, gas, and mining interests, all while still receiving money from his former employers in the oil, gas, and mining industries. Griles' appointment has been a particular boon to a sector of the coal mining industry that is not afraid to think big, the mountaintop removal sector. You see, when you remove the top of a mountain, you gain ready access to what is inside, be it diamonds, molybdenum, or more commonly, bituminous or dirty coal. The thing is, a removed mountaintop doesn't just vanish. The top of the mountain has to go somewhere, and that somewhere is usually a nearby valley. Griles himself had plenty of experience removing unnecessary mountaintops. As an executive at United Company, he oversaw the Daltex mine in West Virginia, which occasioned one of the largest mountaintop removals since Krakatoa. The mine was not what you would call a good neighbor. When miners detonated mountain ridges, filling in valleys and burying streams with trees, rocks, and 13 species of songbird, they also sent boulders flying into local houses. As you can imagine, neighbors complained, not just about the boulders, but also about the choking dust. Grile's inconsiderate behavior did not end with the boulders or the asthma-inducing debris. United Company set up huge coal-loading machines that ran 24 hours a day right next to homes. For years, a number of regulations have interfered with the ability of mining companies to remove mountaintops. For example, until recently, it's been illegal to dump the mountaintop into a nearby stream or river. The Bush administration has changed all that by rewriting the Clean Water Act's rules to allow mining waste to be dumped directly into many heretofore off-limits waterways. The president would argue that our natural resources are best managed by people intimately familiar with all the relevant regulations and statutes and the tricks polluters use to evade them. I agree. Such people include academics, regulators, and environmental advocacy groups, experts all. Oh, but let's not forget the lobbyists for the polluters themselves. In their own way, they are every bit as expert. This last group seems to be disproportionately represented in this administration. There's people like name, Mark Ray, position, Undersecretary of Agriculture for Natural Resources and Environment, currently in charge of forests, previously lobbied for polluters of forests, Bennett W. Raley, Interior Assistant Secretary for Water and Science, currently in charge of water, previously lobbied for polluters of water, Rebecca Watson, Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Land and Minerals Management, currently in charge of land that contains minerals, previously lobbied for polluters of land that contains minerals, Carmen Toohey, Special Assistant to the Secretary of the Interior for Alaska, currently in charge of Alaska, previously lobbied for polluters of Alaska, Patricia Lynn Scarlett, Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Policy, Management, and Budget, currently in charge of Government Regulations, previously lobbied for polluters of everything. I am not going to put you through a long list of horrible environmental actions taken by this administration. Instead, I refer you to what Team Franken calls the Internet. For instance, a Google search of the terms Bush, horrible, environment yields 42,500 websites, some of which discuss Bush's environmental record without any reference to hot, wet Asian girls. Instead, I want to focus on what, for me, is the symbol of the Bush administration's relationship to the environment, the skyscraping pig shit geyser. The scene I described at the beginning of this chapter was not from some science fiction movie. It's very real. It happened on one of the growing number of factory farms that are despoiling vast tracts of America. It's a very, very shitty story. Before we start, allow me to make it clear that I love meat. In fact, I'm eating meat right now. Sitting to my right are two members of Team Franken. Sitting to my left are 2 pounds of summer sausage. 20 years ago, the hogs produced in this country were raised by family farmers. Today, three companies produce 60% of all the hogs in America. And they do it in factory farms, or CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. Concentrated animal feeding operations are, perforce, concentrated animal shitting operations. Every hog produces 10 times as much feces as a human being. Imagine if you produced 10 times as much shit as you do right now. You'd probably be able to listen to this entire book on the can instead of just this one chapter. A single CAFO in Utah is home to 850,000 hogs, producing as much shit as the city of New York. New York City has 14 sewage treatment plants. CAFOs have none. This presents something of a problem. In order to dispose of hog waste, farmers have, since time immemorial, used it as a fertilizer. It's a nice idea. The pig eats an ear of corn and 2 or 3 minutes later takes a dump. The shit is then used as fertilizer to grow more corn, which is then fed to the pig, producing more shit, and so on and so forth. It's the circle of life. The concentration of hundreds of thousands of animals in a small area has disrupted this delicate balance by overloading the shit side of the equation. The waste from 100,000 pigs cannot be recycled in the same way. This is where our lagoons come into play. A typical factory farm lagoon holds anywhere from 5 to 25 million gallons of untreated pig shit. As you might imagine, it smells a bit. In fact, according to pilots, you can smell a CAFO shit lagoon from an altitude of 3,000 feet. The smell also travels horizontally. People lucky enough to live in the vicinity of an industrial hog farm are, with each breath, made keenly aware of the cause of their declining property values. If you live downwind of a CAFO, the value of your property drops 30%. If you drink a glass of orange juice, it tastes like hog shit.
"I've seen grown men cry because their homes stank," says Don Webb, a very sad retired hog farmer.
The shit stink is exacerbated by the practice of spraying excess shit into the air and onto fields of Bermuda grass when the lagoons threaten to overflow. The industry maintains that spraying the shit onto Bermuda grass is a productive way of recycling the sewage, although the grass is so toxic that it will kill any animal that eats it. At any rate, most of the sprayed shit just goes into the environment, seeping into the groundwater, into the air, and into rivers and streams. In 1995, a spill from one of these lagoons killed a billion fish in the Neuse River of North Carolina. Every year since, dead fish have continued to wash up onshore by the tens of millions. They're not dying from the smell. No, these fish are falling prey to a previously unknown life form spawned in the pig shit basins and carried into the river waters, the Pfisteria piscicida. The dinoflagellate is a microscopic, free-swimming, single-cell organism that can mutate into at least 24 different forms, depending on its prey. It attacks the fish, stunning them with one toxin, then liquefying their flesh with another, then feasting on the liquefied skin and tissue. This is why so many fish of the Neuse, dead and alive, sport horrible bloody lesions. The fishermen and bridge keepers of the Neuse have also developed these ugly sores, which is why they don't wear shorts on a first date. Of course, it's hard to get a date when you suffer from lethargy, headaches, and such severe cognitive impairment that you can't remember your own name or dial a telephone number, which Pfisteria also causes. Because the meat industry in this country has become vertically integrated, big meat has put the small independent hog farmer out of business. 20 years ago, there were 27,500 family hog farmers in North Carolina alone. Now there are none. Today, a single company named Smithfield owns more than 70% of the state's hogs. Small farmers are learning that you can't beat big meat. Nobody claims that factory farming is pretty. But its defenders say that it brings economics of scale that drive down the price of meat for consumers. This is true as long as you don't factor in the shit. Bobby Kennedy Jr., president of the Waterkeeper Alliance, told me that if the waste were disposed of legally, the cost of pork from factory farms would be higher than pork from family farms. They cannot produce hogs or pork chops or bacon more efficiently than a family farm without breaking the law. They aren't about the free market because they can't compete without committing criminal acts every day. Their whole system is built on being able to disable or capture government agencies. They're not in favor of responsibility or democracy or private property. It's just about privatizing the air, water, all the things that the public's supposed to own. They are trying to take them away from us, privatize them, and liquidate them for cash. That's the only coherent philosophy they have. That's it. Yeah, Bobby. To be totally honest, I wish the Clinton administration had done more to address the pig shit problem. But at least he was pushing in the right direction. Toward the end of his administration, the EPA issued stringent new CAFO regulations requiring hog factories to take responsibility for their waste and initiating suits against some of the violators. When Bush took office, his appointees gutted the regulations. Eric Schaefer, head of enforcement for the EPA, resigned in disgust after being told to drop the agency's cases against the offending conglomerates. The administration cut a deal granting immunity to factory farm air polluters, and its Republican allies in Congress defeated a proposal by Paul Wellstone to bar hog producers from also owning the slaughterhouses. As Bush's stance on pig shit became clear, you could hear the squeals of joy at Smithfield. They say that a rising tide lifts all boats, but in a pig shit lagoon, the only boat that rises is the one on top of the geyser. Perhaps there is someone listening to this who's saying, give me a break, Al. I don't care about pigs or pig shit or family farms or mountaintops or this Fista Mahoosie or the environment. To you, I have this to say. You were not legitimately elected president, sir. But I respect the office you hold, and I'm honored that you're listening to my audio book. Chapter 39. I meet former First Lady Barbara Bush, and it doesn't go well. During my adult life, the most popular First Lady by far has been Barbara Bush. There was something about the ease of her matronly bearing that made us all feel comfortable. She was everyone's grandmother, even, it sometimes seemed, her husband's. And for those of us on the liberal side, there was always the niggling suspicion that she was secretly pro-choice, but had chosen to keep that between herself and George. Barbara Bush was the benevolent matriarch, somehow above the fray. Oh, an occasional unpleasantry might slip out, like when she called Geraldine Ferraro a bitch. But that was to be expected in the rough and tumble. All in all, Barbara Bush was a role model for wives and mothers throughout the land. That's why I was thrilled when I found myself on a flight from Houston to Washington, D.C., sitting across from our former First Lady. It was January of 2000, just a week or two before the primary season was beginning, and this would be my chance to charm her. I was flying first class because I had just given one of my hilarious and well-received corporate speeches. Mrs. Bush had a window seat, so I was sitting directly across from a Secret Service man who checked me out when I stood up to say hi. I gave him a smile that said, "Don't worry, I'm all right. See, I consider myself a people person, and I know how to handle myself. Anyway, I guess I checked out," because he let me lean in and say, "Excuse me, Mrs. Bush, my name is Al Franken, and I'm a friend of Dana Carvey's." "Oh, well, Dana's a good man." "Yes, Dana is." Dana had done the hilarious, if at times somewhat unflattering, impression of Bush Sr. on Saturday Night Live. Quite generously, the Bushes had invited Dana to the White House after the 1992 election, and I knew they had gotten along famously. See? People person. "I'll bet Dana misses my husband," she said with a wry smile. "Yes, but I'm sure he's working on your son," I responded jauntily. Her smile disappeared. "Well, I don't know of any characteristics that he has that anyone could possibly make fun of." As it so happens, I had found a small W tick and decided it might be fun to show it to his mother. I was sure she'd get a kick out of it. "Well, actually, when he laughs sometimes, his shoulders go up and down like this." Then I did my little impression, W laughing, his shoulders shooting up and down. Her face darkened noticeably. "I've never seen him do that." "Well, I'm sure Dana will do it better. And, of course, it's going to be a very valuable impression," I said. That lightened the moment, so much so that I made what was, in retrospect, an unwise decision. I decided to kid. "You know, until November." A scowl flashed across her face. And dismissing me with an imperious wave of her hand, she issued a stern, "Well, I'm through with you." It was so over the top that I was convinced she was kidding. "Oh, come on, I'm a Democrat," I said, all in good fun. "I gathered that, and I'm through with you." Another wave of the hand. Suddenly, I was dealing with the Queen of Hearts, but I honestly couldn't tell whether she was being serious or just having a bit of fun, in which case, I would have been selling her short just to go back to my seat, so I tried again. I told you, I'm through with you. So I nodded and backed away, looking to the Secret Serviceman for some clue. She's kidding, right? I got nothing from the guy. But, you know, they're trained that way. I spent the next couple of hours reliving the conversation, becoming more and more convinced that Mrs. Bush had the most fabulous sense of humor, and the whole I'm through with you thing was just a hilarious bit of play acting. After dinner was served and cleared, I decided to try again. "Here's something you'll like about me," I said as I approached, which was met with a severe, "I told you, I'm through with you." "Ah, yes, but I'm a friend of John Ellis."
This was true, and in retrospect, a little sad. You may remember John Ellis as the Bush relative who manned the Fox News decision desk on election night and called Florida for his first cousin. I had known John since his days as a political analyst at NBC, though I've lost touch with him since he helped steal the election for his family. Well, John Ellis is a good man. We discussed Ellis for a couple minutes, then I took my leave before she was through with me. Success, I was back in Barbara Bush's good graces. After we landed and were getting our coats, I thought I'd take one last stab at jollying her up. Knowing that Mrs. Bush had always been a champion of literacy programs, I decided to brag on my daughter. "Here's another thing you'll like about me," I said, reaching into the overhead bin above her. "I told you, I'm through with you." Somehow we had regressed. I know, but my daughter teaches kids to read. "We can't take credit for our children," she scolded. "We can't? Sure we can. Look at you, you've got two governors." "I have 5 children," she said with a stern look. "And I'm proud of every one of them. Even Neil?" I thought of saying. He's the one who got mixed up in a sleazy SNL deal in the 80s. But I didn't. Instead, I said, "Well, if you're proud of them, that's kind of like taking credit for them, isn't it?" She just scowled at me one last time and said, "I'm through with you." Then she turned and walked off the plane. I had flown to Washington instead of home to New York to attend the bat mitzvah of my friend's daughter. The dad is an extremely well-regarded political journalist who had written about the Bushes for years, sometimes in glowing terms. Many of the guests would be other Washington insiders, Democrats and Republicans alike. They would know whether Mrs. Bush had just been kidding. I must have told the story 20 times at the bat mitzvah, not during the service. Huge laughs every time. Every "I'm through with you" big laugh. But what everyone who knew Barbara Bush thought was funniest by far was that I had kept thinking that she had been kidding. I kept hearing things like, "Oh no, she's a horrible bitch. Oh my God, she's the worst bitch on earth. She can be very charming, but Barbara Bush is the queen bitch." Understand, this was absolutely universal. And I'd always said in an unadmiring way, "She's the enforcer," or "Barbara's the tough one," or "She's mean, but she keeps everyone in line." But another, even more interesting insight came from everyone who knew the Bushes. They all agreed, "W is her son. He's mean." Now, I don't know George W. Bush. I met him once briefly, and I found him charming and likable. I wrote about it in the paperback edition of Why Not Me, but I think, in the context of this book, it bears repeating. It was August of 1999, and I was covering the Iowa Republican straw poll for George magazine at a front porch event in Indianola, a small town about 15 miles south of Des Moines. As Bush was giving the short version of a standard compassionate conservative stump speech, literally on a front porch, he caught a glimpse of me standing among 15 or so members of the press. He looked a little surprised and gave me a little wink, which I thought at the moment was kind of charming. I mean, he knew who I was. After the speech, he glad-handed the good Iowa neighbors who had come to see him, and then on the lawn held a press availability. I was going to get to ask him questions. We gathered around, and the first thing he did was point to me and say, "I see they're letting anyone in these days." Light, funny. After a few other questions, he called on me. Now, this was the period when the rumors about his cocaine use had first come out. So I said, "Governor, I personally don't care about whether or not you did cocaine years ago when you were a young man, but since we're in Iowa, I feel I have to ask you, have you ever manufactured any crystal meth?" Everyone laughed, including Bush. Again, charming. But, and I think this is the important part, he did not answer. Important not because I think George W. Bush ever cooked a tub of methamphetamines, but because if Bush had answered the question, I would have trapped him, because he had been refusing to answer the coke question. By laughing instead of answering, he had outsmarted me. I talked to him about a couple other things. If you're curious, Why Not Me is still in print. But the point is, I came away from my one interaction with the guy kind of, well, charmed, and that I understand is a very common experience. Don't get me wrong. As you've probably figured out by now, I don't like this president. I don't like his policies. He gives me the willies whenever he speaks. I don't like him. It's because I think he is his mother's son. I think he's mean.
I think we're all too ready to blame Karl Rove or Dick Cheney or Ari Fleischer or Gail Norton or Donald Rumsfeld or John Ashcroft when this administration does something despicable. When South Carolinians get push polls saying John McCain fathered an illegitimate black child, you know Karl Rove had something to do with it. But it's really Bush. When our energy policy is set by cronies from the oil, coal, and automobile industries, you can shake your fist at Dick Cheney, but it's Bush. When Ari Fleischer feeds rumors that the Clinton people vandalized the White House doing $200,000 worth of damage, but months later a GAO report says it ain't true, you can say that Ari Fleischer is a chimp, and he is, but it's Bush. When this administration reinterprets the Clean Water Act to allow polluters to dump into creeks and streams, you can blame Gail Norton or Christy Todd Whitman all you like, but it's Bush. When Donald Rumsfeld refuses to apologize for our military accidentally killing a wedding party of 50 in Afghanistan, you can bet that swaggering callousness emanates from the Oval Office. When an American citizen can be put in prison indefinitely without charges being filed and without access to a lawyer or a judge, you may think John Ashcroft is out of control, and you'd probably be right. But the rest of the time, don't kid yourself. It's Barbara Bush's son. And I'm through with him. Chapter 40. My Personal Search for Weapons of Mass Destruction. This is a chapter I've been putting off for the whole book. At one point, I told Team Franken that I was going to wait until the reconstruction of Iraq was complete to write it, but they said they wanted to read what I had to say when they were still alive. Deep breath. Okay. Here's the thing. I was genuinely torn about the war. On the one hand, I'm not a believer in the Bush doctrine of preemption. I think it could be used to justify wars of aggression, not just by us, but by the Japs. On the other hand, it would be silly to deny that on 9/11, the world changed. On that day, we learned that America was vulnerable to attack. There were hard choices to be made. We were confronting an enemy that was everywhere and nowhere. The person who had to make those choices was the man with all the facts, George Herbert Walker Bush, and his son, the president. So, reluctantly, I became a supporter of the war against Saddam. In my own defense, I should say I wasn't thinking clearly. I was terrified by the imminent threat to me and my family posed by Iraq's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. I was especially frantic about the nuclear device Saddam was building with enriched uranium obtained from Niger. The president had told the entire nation about that in his State of the Union address. My wife was not so worried about the nuclear threat. She was more concerned about a chemical attack on the Frankens. They're doing some construction across from our apartment, and my wife was convinced that the large cement mixer was one of those mobile chemical weapons laboratories that Colin Powell told the UN about. My son Joe, who's normally very level-headed, was less worried about a chemical attack than a biological one. He thought the cement mixer was mixing up a potent batch of ricin, a powerful neurotoxin made from castor beans, and that Saddam was planning to use it on us and the Bellers in 9B. My daughter Thomason shared her brother's concern about biological weapons, but she was less concerned about neurotoxins, which kill reasonably quickly through acute hypoxic respiratory failure, and more worried about lethal viruses, which condemn you to a slow and painful death. All this came out at an emotional family meeting about whether I should speak at a Clear Channel rally supporting the war. Clear Channel, which owns over 400 radio stations, four times as many as the next biggest media conglomerate, was boycotting the Dixie Chicks and sponsoring pro-war rallies around the country. I'd been thinking about doing a radio show, and I knew that Clear Channel was in 247 of the nation's 250 largest radio markets. Franny paced the living room, nervously eyeing the cement mixer. "Is it normal to mix cement at 10 p.m.?" she asked. "Mom," Joe said, "the truck isn't mixing, it's idling. Probably waiting till the temperature is right to ferment the ricin." "You and your ricin," Thomason shouted. "How are they going to weaponize it, butthead? An aerosol? I'm telling you, it's a highly infectious virus such as Lassa, white pox, or any number of the hemorrhagic fevers. There are 8 million delivery systems right here in New York.
Everybody, hello, I broke in. This is a family meeting to decide whether Daddy should speak at a Clear Channel rally for a cause he's not sure he really believes in.
It's all about you, Dad, isn't it?
It's always about you, Thomason said.
I faked a sneeze, sending her fleeing to her bedroom, where she slammed the door and wedged a wet towel in the crack under it.
That's not going to save you, her brother taunted maliciously.
Okay, focus. What about the speech, I asked.
You know you're going to do it, Al. You've already made up your mind, Franny said. Why are we even having this meeting? You always do this. Do you want me to say I think you should do the speech?
Fine, I think you should do the speech.
Ladies, gentlemen, Sports Radio 640 WGST contest winners and Lee Greenwood, welcome to Clear Channel's Let's Iraq and Roll Rally. A special thanks to retired Air Force Major Dave Cranepool for his flyover in that vintage F-102 Delta Dagger. Wow! Today, we are not just Sports Radio 640 WGST listeners, or listeners of WKNR, the channel for classic rock, or Hot 92.7 fans, or inmates of the Morning Asylum with Dave and the Donut Lover. No, today, we're all Americans. Except for NPR listeners, who always seemed a little French to me. Lee Greenwood liked that one. If I could just be serious for a minute, I know your prayers are with our men and women fighting in Iraq, who are there protecting us from Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. You know who really honks me off? Hans Blix. Hans Blix says he can't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, after Saddam Hussein nukes the UN, it's going to be pretty hard to find Hans Blix, right, Lee? Hey, did you hear the Dixie Chicks change their name? They're now the Blixie Chicks. Am I right?
It was not my proudest moment. And not just because it wasn't my A material, although Team Franken is great at crunching budget numbers, they're not so hot with the Dixie Chick jokes. No, my shame was that I had allowed fear to cloud my normally robust skepticism regarding the veracity of the Bush administration. Many of the things they told us about weapons of mass destruction had turned out not to be so true. The uranium from Niger, the aluminum tubes for atomic weapons that Colin Powell told the UN about, Bush's references to a non-existent International Atomic Energy Agency report saying Iraq was 6 months from having a nuke, all the compelling arguments that Iraq posed an imminent threat to the Frankens turned out not to be true. Remember the fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles Saddam was building? Bush told us, quote, "We are concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States." This turned out to be about as plausible as the Malawi space program, which consists of a bucket and one man's dreams. As of this writing, no weapons of mass destruction have been found. What has been discovered is that the Bush administration made its case to the American public on the basis of selectively chosen evidence that they knew was shaky, or worse. In the case of the Niger uranium, for example, the CIA had been telling the White House for a year that the evidence was an obvious forgery. Nevertheless, as I write this, 34% of Americans believe that we have already found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I wish I were among this 34%. Then I wouldn't feel so guilty about whoring myself out to Clear Channel. Perhaps so many Americans believe this because they are watching the number one show on television, not CSI Miami, but Hannity and Combs. During and after the war, Sean Hannity excitedly announced the discovery of actual weapons of mass destruction, or things that seemed to be weapons of mass destruction, or the items that proved that weapons of mass destruction were about to be found. Hannity: I think the weapons of mass destruction will be found. I don't think we have any doubt about that. What are we to make, Combs?
None whatsoever, Sean.
Hannity: What are we to make of these reports that they've discovered these large concentrations of cyanide agent mustard agents in the Euphrates, and the fact that our Marines have found these boxes of suspicious white powder, nerve agent, antidote, Arabic documents on how to engage in chemical warfare. Fox military analyst Lieutenant Colonel Bill Cowan.
Sean, I'm right there with you. No surprises whatsoever that all these things are being found. Maybe even no surprise that the UN inspection team, Hans Blix and company, had been into some of these places and not found anything. Combs.
Colonel, senior defense officials are telling Fox News at this hour that the white substance found in an industrial plant near Baghdad is not a chemical weapon. There was tons of this. Every time I watched Hannity and Combs, Sean was certain they had just found the smoking gun. And then someone, in this case an unusually feisty Combs, would update the story with the information that what had in fact been found was a box of Tide. Or maybe Americans got the impression that we'd already found weapons of mass destruction because they'd heard it from a high-ranking source in the White House, namely the president. On May 29th of this year, President Bush said on national television, "We found the weapons of mass destruction." It was on Polish national television. The president was in Poland to thank them for joining Eritrea, Tonga, and the Solomon Islands in the Coalition of the Willing. If it turns out that the administration deliberately misled Americans and the rest of the world, next time countries like Tonga might not be so willing to lend their support. There are serious questions about the possible deceptions used to win public support for the war. It is increasingly clear that the disinformation campaign, particularly regarding the much-hyped uranium from Niger, emanated from the highest reaches of the government. The question must be asked, what did the president know? And if not, why didn't he know it? If, as may be the case, the president did not understand his intelligence briefings, why didn't he ask to have them explained to him? And did he know he didn't understand them? When President Clinton left office, America enjoyed tremendous respect and admiration around the world. As a candidate, Bush repeatedly emphasized the need for humility in the conduct of our foreign affairs. What would he have done differently in Kosovo? Been more humble. How would he approach the Middle East? With humility. But as soon as he became president, Bush managed to spend Clinton's surplus of international goodwill in astonishingly short order. He ditched Kyoto, the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the germ warfare protocol to the Biological Weapons Convention, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the International Criminal Court, and the Landmine Treaty, and did it all with a decided lack of humility. He didn't say, "We hope you don't mind, we're very sorry, but we have to withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol. I feel terrible that we're not able to live up to our responsibility to take a leadership role in addressing the impending global warming crisis," or something like that. I'm no diplomat, but there must have been some way to be nicer about it. No, he had to go piss the world off. Not once, but twice. You see, the day after 9/11, we got the world back on our side. All over the planet, there were spontaneous outpourings of sympathy, support, and genuine affection for the United States. It was a terrible way for it to happen, but it gave Bush a second start. Then, he pissed them all off again. His administration showed an almost reflexive contempt for even the idea of listening to the rest of the world. Like when Cheney told the world that he didn't give a shit about weapons inspectors. And Bush's response to whether the largest simultaneous anti-war protests in human history had made any sort of impression on him. "Size of protest," he said. "It's like deciding, well, I'm going to decide policy based on a focus group." A 10 million person focus group. Several months ago, I saw former President Clinton on C-SPAN giving a speech about globalization to the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke for a couple hours with just a few notes, displaying an incredible depth and breadth of understanding. In a way, it made me miss him. But to be fair to Bush, there's more to being president than simply being articulate, intelligent, and knowledgeable. I still really hope we find weapons of mass destruction. Not just because my Clear Channel fiasco is on tape, but because if we don't, the rest of the world will trust us even less than they do now. I'm not sure why that matters. Maybe terrorism or the international drug trade or global ecological disasters or emerging infectious diseases or transnational cybercrime. I don't know. It's just that maybe someday one of those things might involve working with a foreign country. Chapter 41, The No Child Left Behind Standardized Test. In compliance with the president's recent educational initiatives, teachers using this volume as a textbook are encouraged to teach to the test. The practice questions below are the questions that will appear on the test and determine whether your school will receive federal, state, and local funding. In accordance with the Texas model, please ensure that your lowest performing students have dropped out prior to the test date. Section 1. Math Skills. 1. In the No Child Left Behind Act, Congress authorized a $5.6 billion increase in Title I spending for low-income children. However, President Bush budgeted only $1 billion for Title I. If the Title I program calls for $2,800 per poverty-level student, how many children are left behind? A. 0. B. 1. C. 7. D. 1,643,857. 2. In the No Child Left Behind Act, Congress authorized an expansion of transportation and other support services to an additional 130,000 homeless children. Instead of an increase, the president's budget froze funding for the homeless education program. Because of inflation, this meant 8,000 fewer homeless children could be served than in the previous year. Assuming there is no increase in homelessness this year, how many homeless children are left behind? A. 0. B. 8. C. 13. D. 138,000. 3. In the No Child Left Behind Act, Congress authorized increased funding to help school districts meet the mandate that all teachers in core academic subjects be, quote, highly qualified by the end of the 2005-2006 school year. By freezing funding for the Teacher Quality State Grant Program, the Bush budget trains 92,000 fewer teachers than were promised by the Act. Assuming each teacher teaches 4 classes a day of 25 students each, and does guidance counseling for 8 additional students, how many children are left behind? A. 0. B. 25. C. 33. D. 9,936,000. 4. There are 72 million children in the United States. If George leaves 1,643,857 children behind by cutting Title I programs, and leaves 138,000 children behind by freezing spending for homeless education programs, and leaves behind 9,936,000 by slashing teacher training, what percentage of America's children has George left behind? A. 0%. B. 1.63%. C. 16.3%. D. 163%. Section 2. Verbal Skills. 1. Teddy agreed to throw his support behind the No Child Left Behind Act because George had promised to fully blank it. When George presented his budget, Teddy felt blank. Which pair of words best fills in the blanks? A. Undermine, excited. B. Comprehend, appreciative. C. Transcribe, Betsy. D. Fund, betrayed. 2. George W. Bush said education is my top priority. He was being A. mendacious. B. rebarbative. C. risible. D. all of the above. 3. Sometimes in life, it is okay to tell a little blank, but you should always avoid blank. Which pair best fills in the blanks? A. White lie to the American public, getting caught. B. story that tugs at the heartstrings. Being mawkish. C. Joke to lighten the mood. Running with scissors. D. Kid that you're going to fund his education. Following through. 4. Correct the punctuation in the following sentence. Quote, George W. Bush is the president who, comma, in God's name, comma, will protect our children, period, end quote. A. The sentence is correct. B. George W. Bush is the president who, in God's name, will protect our children, period. C. George W. Bush is the president, period. Who, comma, in God's name, comma, will protect our children, question mark. D. George W. Bush is the president, period. Who, comma, in God's name, comma, will protect our children, question mark, exclamation point. Chapter 42. What is a lie? Throughout this book, I've used the terms lie, liars, lying, and O'Leary. Rather, you might say liberally. Calling someone a liar is a serious charge. It's not quite as bad as calling someone a traitor, as Ann Coulter does in her new book, The Treason Diet. But it's serious. Telling the truth is something I take seriously. And I try to hold myself to an impossibly high standard. For example, Coulter's book isn't really titled The Treason Diet. It's titled Treason, Liberal Treachery from the Cold War to the War on Terrorism. Yes, lying is a serious matter. And calling the President of the United States a liar is not something I say with any relish or self-satisfaction. I wish with all my heart that our President wasn't a liar, or if he were, that he was more like President Clinton. Bush lies about important things, like the economy, his tax cuts, education, our reasons for going to war, and drunk driving. But I think he lies only when he feels he has to. He knows that most of the time, Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and Rush Limbaugh are only too glad to do it for him. And all the lies, small and large, add up. They create a worldview in which the mainstream media is a liberal propaganda machine, in which Democrats are ruthless, manipulative power grabbers, and also sissies, where if you're poor, you should blame yourself, and for everything else, blame Clinton. Where Democrats feed a culture of victimhood, but where the real victims are decent, hard-working white males. The right-wing media's lies create a world in which no one needs to feel any obligation to anybody else. It's a worldview designed to comfort the comfortable and further afflict the afflicted. In a surprising moment of candor, the Weekly Standard's Matt LaBash told an interviewer, "The conservative media likes to rap the liberal media on the knuckles for not being objective. We've created this cottage industry in which it pays to be unobjective. It pays to be subjective as much as possible. It's a great way to have your cake and eat it too. Criticize other people for not being objective. Be as subjective as you want. It's a great little racket. I'm glad we found it, actually." It is a great racket, and not just for their media, but for Bush and everyone around him. Bush is good at make-believe. He says what he has to say, but he gives tax cuts to his supporters, throws business to his cronies, quietly guts environmental protections, and leaves millions of children behind. He calls himself a compassionate conservative. That's the biggest lie of all. The right-wing media racket lets Bush get away with it. When the mainstream media dares to tell the truth about Bush, they're called bias. This book, no doubt, will be accused by some of having a liberal bias. See how shameless they are? They'll stop at nothing. Yes, I'm a liberal, and I'm proud of it. It's a term we need to reclaim, because I believe most Americans are liberals just like me. Most Americans believe in helping people, and most Americans believe that government has a role to play, to create opportunity, to protect the environment, to provide for the common good. We are the country, but they control it. Only 7% of Americans say they want to weaken environmental regulation, but the 7% are in charge. How do we get it back? We have to fight. But we can't fight like they do. People say that Rush and Fox and their ilk are popular because they're entertaining. And if you can stomach that stuff, I suppose they are. But a part of their entertainment value comes from their willingness to lie and distort. They fight with lies. We can't do that. We have to fight them with the truth. Our added entertainment value will have to come from being funny and attractive and passionate and idealistic, but also smart and not milquetoasty. We've got to be willing to throw their lies in their face. When we say, "Hey, Dr. Wolfowitz, didn't the Clinton military do a great job in Iraq?" and they say, "Fuck you," we've got to come right back and say, "No, fuck you." That's how we're going to win this thing. Truth to power, baby. Recently, flying back from one of my widely acclaimed corporate speeches, I sat next to an avuncular Methodist minister. I told him about my book. He smiled warmly and responded with an interesting nugget from the New Testament. "Do you know what God's punishment is for liars?" he asked me. Guessing wildly, I tried. "They're turned into donkeys?" "No," he said. "God's punishment for liars is that they believe their own lies." I thought that would be a great ending for this book. They believe their own lies. How fitting. That's just the kind of thing God would think of. So I asked God where exactly in the Bible he said that. God told me that the Methodist minister had his head up his ass. It doesn't say that in the Bible. And in a way, that's an even better ending. Because I don't think they do believe their own lies. Anybody, even a Methodist minister, can make an innocent mistake and say something that isn't true. But lying is when you intentionally deceive. While it might not seem like I'm changing the tone when I accuse my friends on the right of being liars, my hope is that if we keep calling them on their calculated dishonesty, their dishonesty will lose its effectiveness. Then O'Reilly and company will have to resort to Plan B, name-calling, which I think will expose them for what they are. Stupid bastards.
This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.